Good morning.
Good morning.
I think this is the fourth or fifth lecture on this section of Gyoji that I've been talking about. I'm just going to read the paragraph again. The first patriarch in China came from the west to the eastern lands at the instruction of the venerable Prajnatara. For 3 years of frosts and springs during that ocean voyage, how could the wind and snow have been the only miseries? Through how many formations of cloud and sea mist might the steep waves have surged? He was going to an unknown country. Ordinary beings who value their body and life could never conceive of such a journey. This must have been the maintenance of the practice realized solely from the great benevolent will to transmit the Dharma and save deluded beings. And today we're going to talk about the part here that is, well, I guess it was so because the transmission of Dharma is Bodhidharma himself. It was so because the transmission of Dharma is the entire universe. It was so because the whole universe in 10 directions is the real state of truth. It is so because the whole universe in the 10 directions is Bodhidharma himself. And it was so because the whole universe in 10 directions is the whole universe in the 10 directions. What conditions surrounding this life are not a royal palace? And what royal palace is prevented from being a place to practice the truth? For these reasons, he came from the West like this. Because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself. He was without alarm and doubt. He was not afraid. Because saving deluded emotional beings is the entire universe. He was not alarmed and doubting, and he was without fear. He left his father's kingdom forever and made ready a great ship, crossed the southern seas, and arrived at the port of Koshu. So what I'm going to talk about today is that very last part of the text. And as you may recall, we've talked about the similarities between Dogen's life and Bodhidharma and Shakyamuni Buddha somewhat. In particular, Bodhidharma went to China from India, and Dogen went to China from Japan. Both of them crossed the sea, so both of them had a tough journey. And this can be our life, our spiritual life as well. So the part today is what conditions surrounding this life are not a royal palace? And what royal palace is prevented from being a place to practice the truth? I find this kind of an enigmatic statement by Dogen. Hi, you weren't here before.
No.
what's your name?
Come Mona.
Excuse me?
Mona.
Yeah. Welcome. My name is Shinshu. Okay, so Dogen could be talking about a couple things here by talking about a palace. Shakyamuni Buddha was said to have lived in a palace. This is kind of the myth of Shakyamuni, was that he lived in a palace. His father was a king. And his father had received a prediction when Buddha was born, that the Buddha would either be a great political leader or he would be a great spiritual leader. And so what happened was that his dad decided to completely isolate him so that he would never experience anything that smacked of suffering. And therefore, he would not be interested in the spiritual life because his father understood that the spiritual life is often predicated upon the question, how do I end suffering? Right? So his logic was, if there was no suffering, if Shakyamuni never saw any suffering, there wouldn't be a problem. So Shakyamuni Buddha grew up in a palace. Also, Dogen was born to a high-ranking imperial family. So he grew up in some kind of upper-class situation. And Bodhidharma, he also was a prince. So Bodhidharma's dad was supposedly a king. So Bodhidharma was one of three brothers, and when he was shown a precious jewel of unique value, he immediately understood it to be not about the worldly value of the jewel, but a metaphor for spiritual attainment. So this is part of the story of the biography of Bodhidharma. And Dogen, when he was faced with a question of should he do spiritual life or become a governmental official when he was 13, decided to become ordained as a Tendai monk. So, you know, I can't help but see some parallels here between Dogen mentioning this business of being in a palace. The other thing about being a palace is that we could say and talk about our own lives as being in a palace in a couple of different ways. One way is that as Americans, I would say probably almost everyone in this room, despite the fact that we may have had a lot of difficulties in our life in one way or the other, that we are living a pretty good life. So for some other people, they might look at our life and say, whoa, those folks are living in a palace. There's also the aspect to this in which our true nature, our radiant true nature, is the nature of a prince, the nature of a king, the nature of the sense of that we do live in a palace. We live in the Buddha field of Shakyamuni Buddha. Even though that Buddha field is a field of suffering in many ways, still it is, if you will, the palace of Shakyamuni Buddha. It is the Buddha field that we live in, and that our true nature is this radiant, as Dogen says, komiya, we are this radiant nature. All of life is this radiance. So in that way, there's a sense of we are kings in a way. We are spiritual kings, and that we live in a palace. So you could think about it that way. So we could ask ourselves, what royal family am I in, right? And I don't mean this in the sense of, you know, is my religious school better than somebody else's? I mean it in the sense of just looking at our ability to wake up, just looking at our true nature, and realizing in a way that even though this is the birthright of absolutely every being and person in the world, everything in the world is Buddha nature. Everything in the world is this aspect of making the world in this altruistic way, this way in which we say, what, you know, what is it? What is this aspect of myself, the totality of myself, that is already completely in accord with the world, already completely having this ability to be skillful? What is that part of myself, which isn't actually a part, but a whole? And yet, how do I allow that to come forward? How do I discern what that is? How do I know how to be that? How to respond from that place? So what royal family are we in? What palace do we inhabit? So usually, if we think of a palace, we might think of it in the way that Shakyamuni's father did. We might think of it as a place of intrigue or a place of something very secular, right? We think of a palace as being maybe the seat of government in some ways, if we're talking about a kind of political system in which there is a palace, right? So this way that's very secular. So I think Dogen is also saying, even in your secular life, in this palace of your secular life, this representation of secular life, that is where our practice is. Our practice isn't somewhere else. So we like to think, especially when we first come to practice, we like to think, oh, I have to go somewhere else. If I could only go to that palace called the monastery, if I could only go to that other place than where I am, that's, of course, a better place in our imagination. If I can only be enlightened in the palace of my mind, you know, have a certain kind of enlightenment experience, then everything would be better. Or if I could just get away from this secular life. So Dogen's saying, no, it's right here. So there's this way in which the palace can represent, be a metaphor for our secular life. It can be a metaphor for the home of our spiritual self, the home of our true self. You can look at this both ways. But he's saying, what conditions surrounding this life are not a royal palace? So looking at conditions, the causes and conditions of our life, even the causes and conditions are, in particularly because of the causes and conditions that create, that cause us suffering, it drives us to spiritual practice. Some question drives us to practice. Anyone here think practice is easy? Right? So practice requires our effort. And we do it because, well, we start out doing it because we think we're going to get something from it, right? We have an idea that we're going to get serenity, or we're going to get this or that or the other thing, or whatever the problem is, that somehow this is going to solve it. And then we find out at some point that the motivation is that this is our true nature, and this is practice. It's just expressing what already is. So we aren't practicing to get anything, we're just practicing because this is the expression of realization. So sometimes we can feel that very deeply, and at other times, maybe that's a little harder to get in touch with. So these conditions that surround our life, these conditions are our life. This Saha world is our life. So these conditions of our life include joy and friendship, but it also includes difficulties, and it includes suffering. And it is the very suffering and difficulties that help us, that frame the nature in many ways of our practice. So as individuals, we have difficulties with particular things. We might have a particular kind of relationship difficulty. That's a Dharma gate. That's where we go to the teachings and we say, how can I understand? How can I figure out to work with my life using the teachings in this particular problem? Because that's usually the place where we apply it. We don't usually say to ourselves, I am so happy. I need a Dharma gate. You know, I'm so happy. Please, I have to go to the teachings and figure out how to do this work. Usually it's more about, I am so unhappy. And, okay, now I'll practice because I'm really unhappy because it's hard. Okay, now I'll meditate because this is like, you know, something's happening in my life and I'm struggling with it. But these causes and conditions are just the nature of reality itself. This is what it is to be a human being. This is what it is to live in this world. This is what it is to be in the Saha world, to be in Shakyamuni Buddha's Buddha field. And that's why we do bodhisattva practice. That's what our practice is as bodhisattvas, is this response to what is this response. So this march today is a response, right? This march today about all of these shootings that are happening in schools is about bodhisattvas rising up and saying, no, we really have to address this. We really insist that you pay attention to this. Because people get distracted. People get distracted and have all these other things and all these other causes and conditions going on in their life. I'm talking about politicians now. You know, they get distracted. So it's not even a question of, is this person good or is this person bad? It's not like that. I don't think it helps to see it that way. I think it's more helpful to say, there is so much that's distracting the minds of these people, so much that's pushing them over here, that you need some kind of clarity. And we have a lot of bodhisattvas right now who are out there being very clear about what needs to happen. There's a section in the Lotus Sutra where somebody is saying to Buddha, they're saying, Buddha's announced that he's going to die, and they're saying, oh, you know, what can we do? You know, we have to carry on your teachings and all of this. And Buddha says, well, actually, there are all these bodhisattvas who've been chanting all the time, and the earth opens up. And thousands of bodhisattvas rise up from the earth, and they've been under the earth chanting all this time, sustaining, right, this practice, sustaining this teaching, sustaining what is. I think of these marches, these are the bodhisattvas who are coming up out of the earth. You know, they're going to Washington, and they're in Philadelphia. I was watching TV this morning, and they're all, you know, you can see lots of folks out there. They're going to Aptos. So this way in which bodhisattvas, these are the causes and conditions of our life. This is the causes and conditions of what it is to live in this world. And so how are we going to respond to that? This is our palace. What conditions surrounding this life are not a royal palace? And what royal palace is prevented from being a place to practice the truth? So no matter where you are, in each moment, that's a place to practice. For these reasons, Bodhidharma came from the West like this. You know, there's this, when we say, for these reasons, so this is the reason of Bodhidharma as a bodhisattva whose vow was to go and save deluded beings. But he says, came from the West like this. So this phrase, like this, is things as they are, things just as they are. This is Bodhidharma as all of reality, Bodhidharma as the particularity of Bodhidharma. So he says, for these reasons, for this bodhisattva vow, he, Bodhidharma, came from the West just like this, like this. And then he says, and what royal palace is prevented from being a place to practice the truth? So every place we are, we can practice the truth. And the next section is, because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, so that is Bodhidharma just like this, Bodhidharma like this, because saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, he was without alarm and doubt, he was not afraid. So here, Dogen's saying that this bodhisattva activity, this reason of the bodhisattva activity of Bodhidharma is Bodhidharma. And Bodhidharma is the universe. And this universe, Bodhidharma, is stable mind and fearless. Each particular thing and each person is endowed as the universe. We are not separate. We are unique. So this is interesting to me from a practice point of view. So we look at, so what I've just said is that essentially everything, every particular thing has this radiance, has this bodhisattva true nature. This, we are all the bodhisattva activity of Buddhadharma, of Bodhidharma, of the universe. We are all endowed with a stable mind and fearlessness. Right? But it doesn't feel that way. You know? We too are this thing. So I was talking to somebody the other day who was saying that she was, her practice was to see the oneness in everything. Like to see the oneness in people all the time. And that can be actually be a trap. So we have to be careful about this way of universalizing this doctrine of emptiness or the absolute. Or maybe this, it's a false palace in some ways. that we realize that at the same time, and not separate from this, not different from this universal nature, is the particular. So we as people, as individuals, as particular people, are particular people at the same time that we are completely, universally, one with all being. So how exactly does that work? Because what was happening for this person is they were saying, well, if everything is oneness, then I should always look to that and never notice the differences. Never be critical. Never, in a sense, use my discerning mind. Right? That I should never think that maybe there's a problem here. Right? So that's the danger of, this is one danger of only trying to look at things from the position of the absolute. Only trying to look at things from the position of this universality. We also need to, at the same time, use our discerning minds. So this way that Trungpa Rinpoche said about idiot compassion. Idiot compassion is compassion where you're just running around going, oh, we're all the same, we're all the same, we're all the same. And I don't, you know, everything's okay. I don't need to pay attention to that. But actually, we do need to pay attention to it. I think for us, about the discernment part of this universal nature, is that we discern what is helpful in relationship to the larger needs of the whole, and try to set aside our particular needs that are unwholesome and not helpful, right? Our likes and dislikes that are not helpful. So sometimes that's like really hard to do, to set that aside, because we don't know what our likes and dislikes are. We don't know what we're up to sometimes, you know? So we need to pay attention. We can feel it in our body sometimes. We can feel this uprising of different, you know, alarm, I don't want to listen to this person. So we can listen to ourselves and say, oh, is this discernment I'm having, is this something about some way in which I'm bringing the self forward, trying to get my own way in a way that's not particularly helpful and not necessary? Or is this actually a you know, ding, 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 because this is an unwholesome situation, because I need to look at this? Do you know what I'm saying? So there's this way in which this particular aspect of the self is real. I mean, it's not a way. It's really important that we see that, and at the same time that we hold this universality of it as well. So these two things go together. They're not separate. The absolute is not something separate from the particular. They're the same thing. But when we talk about it, it's like, you know, holding up a coin at the face side and the tail side. So we say relative and absolute. But the reality is like when you spin the coin and you can't see the heads or the tails. It's just like, you know, going around. So it's that place that is actually reality, not absolute, relative. So when we say here, because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, he was without alarm and doubt, he was not afraid. Because saving beings is the entire universe, or up here where it says, it's earlier in the text, I'm sorry, but where it says Bodhidharma is the universe, and makes these connections between these two things that Dogen does. Bodhidharma, it was so because the transmission of Dharma is the entire universe. It was so because the whole universe in the 10 directions is the real state of truth. It was so because the whole universe in 10 directions is Bodhidharma himself. And it was so because the whole universe in 10 directions is the whole universe in 10 directions. So what Dogen's talking about here is this way in which all of those things, the whole universe, Bodhidharma, the transmission of the Dharma, which is the whole universe transmitting the Dharma through its appearance and arising in this moment, is the whole universe in the 10 directions, making the whole universe in the 10 directions. So we have to be careful about that kind of statement to understand that I think that those statements are absolutely true and they're very inspiring, but we can't forget the fact that we're living in a particular time, place, being, with particular circumstances. So while we ask ourselves, as Dogen says in Genjo Koan, am I carrying the self forward in a way that's not helpful? Am I carrying the self forward in a way that is a problem? Right? To carry the self forward is delusion. Sometimes we do carry the self forward in a way that is helpful, but to be completely attached to the self, having in your own way, like McDonald says, you know, it's like, that doesn't work. You know, when we're little kids, we want to have it our own way. And if we don't get it our own way, we throw ourselves on the ground and start crying and carrying on and, you know, do all this stuff. And then at some point, we figure out through socializing that doesn't work very well. And so we start to modify our behavior because, well, we figure it works a lot better to get what we want if we start acting a little differently than that. So there's but that's still a very self-serving way of interacting with other people. So then there's that way of the parent where you're seeing the bigger picture, hopefully, where you're seeing the larger picture and saying, what's the most helpful thing to do here in this circumstance? It's not about never having an opinion. It's not about never pushing for some point of view. But you really have to ask yourself, is this point of view coming from a place of delusion? And one of the ways that we can answer that question is to say, okay, how are we the same with each other? You know, how can I reconnect with this sameness? How can I reconnect with this larger picture, which is the totality of the universe, in a way that's not abstract? Rounded, right? Now, then we can act. Then we can respond. And it requires listening. It's one of the great things about Zazen. In Zazen, we just sit down and presence ourselves. So Zazen outside of Zazen, formal Zazen, this Zazen of going to a meeting, the Zazen of listening to somebody else, the Zazen of, you know, what's called active listening, being present for that, is really important. That's that allowing the universality to come forward. Bodhidharma must have done that when he went to India. Dogen says later on in the text, he says, India was really uncouth. You know, the Indians were doing all sorts of wild and crazy stuff, and Bodhidharma had come from this royal family, and I'm sure everything was wonderful in India, and he gets there, and, you know, I don't know, maybe the temples weren't swept out very well or something. And so there's this way in which Bodhidharma, he's okay with that. Bodhidharma's willing to open up to this different culture. He's willing to modify. But he doesn't forget the teachings. The modification is about bringing forward the teachings. It's not about letting go of his discerning mind. So Dogen says, because the saving of deluded beings is Bodhidharma himself, he was without alarm and doubt, and he was not afraid. So, it's interesting that he was without alarm. Oh, I'm sorry. There's one other thing I wanted to say about this business about personal particularity and the larger thing, which is that I was reading a book called Copincino Remembered, which was up at Jokoji. And so Copincino founded Jokoji Zen Center, and he also was really instrumental. I believe he also founded Santa Cruz Zen Center, and he was very important to Tassajara and to San Francisco Zen Center, and he also was a major teacher at the Shambhala Center with Trungpa Rinpoche, as was Suzuki Roshi. So Copincino kept going back to Naropa and teaching. He taught archery and various things. And so he was a really important teacher for a lot of Tibetan practitioners as well. And I read that a student asked Kobun Chino once, he said, "What's the difference between you and Trungpa Rinpoche?" Mm-hmm. So I thought that was kind of interesting question. And then Kobun Chino said, this is paraphrase, Kobun Chino said, "Trungpa Rinpoche tried to change the world through a big movement. He likened him to like a knight in front of an army." And that, and if you know anything about Trungpa Rinpoche, he really tried to tailor the practice to different groups of people. So he had this kind of militaristic group that they wore uniforms and they'd go out and put the flag up every day. And so they were called the Vajra Guard. And then there were people who were ordained. And so he had this whole range of various activities that people could do based on their personalities. And Pema Chodron is a student of Trungpa Rinpoche. So anyway, Kobun Chino says, "Trungpa Rinpoche tried to change the world through a big movement. He wanted to affect and recruit a lot of people for Buddhism." So that was how Kobun Chino characterized Trungpa Rinpoche's teaching. And then he said of himself, he said, "I'm just one person who, when meeting another person who is suffering, I try to hold them with kindness." So his practice was to meet each person. He wasn't trying to do a big movement. He was just presenting his own practice, and when he met somebody and he felt like they were suffering, he tried to meet them at that place. So Kobun traveled around a lot. He went to various places, and I met him at Tassajara once. And he was a very interesting guy. And but he in some ways he moved in a very big sphere in that he was traveling around doing a lot of teaching, but in some ways he was also just this person who was a very powerful person without such a big movement around him. So the reason I'm bringing this up also is to say, you know, we each have our place. We each have our personality. So we have some notion about what this big practice is that we're supposed to be doing. But I think we also need to acknowledge who we are as individuals. We need to acknowledge that, you know, Kobun Chino functioned in a certain way that fit his personality. Trungpa Rinpoche functioned in another way that fit his personality. Pema Chodron functions in another way, the Dalai Lama does. And all of those ways of functioning as bodhisattvas fit that person, their personality, right? So that's okay. We don't have to come up with some big idea about what it is to do bodhisattva practice. We don't have to be a bodhidharma and go to another country and do this practice. But this is a metaphor as well, this whole story about going on a journey, because this journey is our life, right? This journey is our life. And this journey is on the ocean. And then on a relative level, the ocean can be really a wild and crazy place, right? The ocean can be amazing and powerful, and all the surf comes up and there's huge waves and the tsunamis and all of the things that happen with the ocean. And yet the ocean is also a metaphor for realization, this vast universal ocean. The ocean is a metaphor for a lot of things because it's such a powerful image in our minds. So this ocean that we're traveling on, this journey that we're making, that Dogen made, that Bodhidharma made, that Shakyamuni Buddha made, that Trungpa Rinpoche made, that Kobun Chino made, that we're all making, this life, our life is our journey that we're making. And this Dharma, Buddha Dharma Sangha, this refuge that we're taking, in a way is a foundation for that journey. This understanding that we are the true nature, each one of us is making the world, everything is making the world, that all of us are simultaneously not separate from, but part of the process of the causes and conditions of this life, of all of life, in the activities that we engage in, the way that we understand, is on one level, it's a kind of responsibility. It's kind of overwhelming responsibility if you think about it that way. But it's also, as Kobun said, "I just meet each person. I just meet each situation. I just live my life in each situation. And in that way, it's not so big. It's just this life. It's just my practice. So Bodhidharma had this large vision of, and a deeper understanding that this life in and of itself is all of that. This life is causing conditions. This life is impermanent. And yet in the midst of this impermanence, we are never not this life. And that gave him a kind of confidence and faith and trust and a willingness to be in the middle of the ocean, sometimes beautiful and sometimes a tsunami, and to have this deep faith, not that everything was going to be hunky-dory all the time, because I'm sure he didn't think that, because he's living in this world, he wasn't stupid, you know, but this deep faith and a willingness to see himself within this larger context, which included the loss of self, right? Which included letting go of the self when it was appropriate. Death, what are we afraid of? You know, we're afraid of the loss of self. And so letting go when it's appropriate to let go. Letting go and having this deep sense of that this life, this expectation that we're not going to escape that. What is this? What's that phrase we all love? We're not getting out of this alive, you know? And yet we do get out of death alive because we are never apart from this totality. What doesn't get out of death alive is our sense of self, right? What doesn't get out is my likes and dislikes. What doesn't get out is this, you know, deep clinging to what we know. We just want to cling to what we know. I don't care how bad it is. You know, I got to hold on. I got to hold on. I don't care how bad it is. You know, that. And then inevitably, we let go because we let go, you know. But this birth and death, from a Buddhist point of view, is just arbitrary. This birth and death are just names that we give to these life, what we consider to be big milestones in our life. But from the universal point of view, birth and death is just causes and conditions. Birth and death is just change, impermanence. That's it. You know? And transformation. Transformation. So when we die, it's transformation. But we probably don't get out of it with our consciousness intact. I know that there are religions that say we do, and I think that we like that a lot. You know, oh, I'm going to heaven. I'm going to get up there. St. Peter's going to say, Shinshu, you know, hi, how you doing? Like, how was your life? How did it go? You know, are you going to heaven? You going to hell? I don't know, you were a Buddhist. Maybe not so good. You know, maybe good. Well, okay, it's okay. God loves everybody. So this way in which, you know, we think we're going to go on and we're going to have this mind or we're going to be reborn in another lifetime. And if we're really high status, we're going to be reborn and we're going to know who we are, right? We're going to say, oh yeah, I used to be, you know, so-and-so. I was a tulku. I'm on my way back now. Bring me my mala and stuff, you know, so I can use that this lifetime. But for most of us, I just don't think that happens. So if that happens, great, you know, lovely. But in the meantime, for myself anyway, for the meantime, I prefer this teaching of that my life comes up. I am this particular being in this moment, and then it becomes, transforms into all of life again, just whatever that is. I don't know what that is. I think Bodhidharma, that is such a source of fear for us. You know, such a source of doubt for us. A source of angst for us. Bodhidharma, he didn't have that problem according to Dogen. You know, he wasn't afraid. He was able to go on this journey And the last part of this is, he left his father's kingdom forever. He was never going back. That's also true for us, you know. Time seems to march on. We get older. Most of us know this right in the room. You look in the mirror and you go, wow. It's kind of mind-boggling that there's nothing to stop this train. So, Bodhidharma left his father's kingdom forever. He made ready a great ship. This, your life, is a great ship. He made ready. Our practice is a great ship. Our practice is, you know, it's about nourishment and bringing water on board and making sure we have enough citrus fruit so we don't get scurvy. You know, this way in which we pack the ship, we bring things on, we understand things, we learn how to navigate the ocean. We learn how to do this. And yet at the same time, it's the ocean. You know, there's going to be storms. The mast on the ship is going to not be knocked off one night, you know. So that we cultivate the stability to be able to respond to our life. So he left his father's kingdom forever. He made ready a great ship and he crossed the southern seas. Every day, every moment, we're crossing the southern seas. Thank you very much.